obviously I've heard of AI, and
okay,
a while ago I heard that there was AI generated art that was like melting people's brains, but right. I had never actually looked into it or followed it or actually seen the images until the last few weeks. And I wouldn't say that I've fully gone down the rabbit hole with it, but there's one Instagram page in particular called Artomaton, I think.
Oh, okay.
That is all, they call it retrofuturism. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the way that the future was represented in mid-century, the middle of the 20th century. So the idea
you
of
mean like by the fascists or after the fascists?
By North America, like
post
Second World War futurism.
Like the Jetsons.
Exactly. Yes. And so it's these images of, you know, whatever it is. I think the premise of the page is that it's how a world's fair in the distant future would have been imagined by someone in 1950s America.
Right.
But it's styled, so it has all the kind of trappings of mid-century America, like the way that people are dressed, like they almost, there's like a, you know, an airline stewardess vibe to a lot of the costuming.
Right.
And yeah, like you said, Jetsons, like the idea of space and travel and convenience. And yeah, it's really, really fascinating.
Detailed and like looks like the exact style of art that you would expect that you would see. And I've been exposed to some of that stuff as well. I'm pretty into tech, as I'm sure you're aware,
right.
And so I listened to a lot of like tech podcasts, and when all of that AI art stuff was like blowing up a few months ago or whatever,
mm-hmm.
when DALL-E 2, well, I guess it was like in the summer when DALL-E 2 came online. DALL-E 2 is like, I think it's sort of like a big model that is like kept on a server and you can interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think DALL-E 2 is owned and operated by OpenAI.
Okay.
But then like right after DALL-E 2 came out, there were like a whole bunch of like smaller sort of cracks at it that mm-hmm. were also like very, I don't know, like very successful
mm-hmm.
In like translating people's prompts into like pretty amazing looking art.
Yeah.
One of them is called Stable Diffusion, and you can actually like run that on your own computer. It doesn't have to be like, I mean, it's slow if you have a slow computer, but you right. know, like for, and I think, I don't exactly know how it works and I haven't tried to run it, but I think if you have like a really good GPU, that speeds it up.
Mm-hmm.
So people with gaming computers, it like runs pretty well.
I see.
Yeah. And then there's this one called, what is that called? Come on, Shale. Starts with an M.
Is it Midjourney or Middle
Midjourney? Midjourney. Oh, thank you, Alan. Oh yeah. God. Thank God. Midjourney is like this other one, and you access it through like a Discord chat.
Mm-hmm.
You put things in Discord chat, and then it like picks up your prompts and gives you back images, and then you can interact with it and like get it to change things or make parts of things better.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really had much exposure to it either. But last week, like I was just playing around a little bit and joking around with some friends on Messenger, and they were posting memes, and I was like, oh, I should just generate a weird meme from one of these AI art generators.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went looking at Midjourney, and yeah, it's pretty crazy what it can do.
Yeah.
But it's also there, it also has like these very specific limitations that just make it not very useful for certain types of things. Like it cannot make hands for some reason.
I've noticed some weird stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like every time I've, you know, tried to generate a picture with anyone with hands in it, like the hands have like too many fingers and they're coming out of the wrong places and they're pointed in the wrong direction. And it's honestly a little bit disturbing.
The artistic side of it is what was really blowing my mind, the artistic sensibility that it was able to capture. Like it's almost like what I was thinking of mostly with this Artomaton page, Artomaton, I guess is probably how it's said, was that if you were to do a film adaptation of the book Brave New World, this is the costuming and set design done for you.
Right, basically. Like, you have a really great starting point and you didn't have to do any work.
It is the jumping off point. Which just blew my brain.
I mean, like, the one thing that I sort of have kicking around in my head about that whole thing, about this year being this, like, sort of point in time where it's kind of jumped over the line to where it's doing things that people that like AI, like, models and machine learning models are doing things that people didn't expect that they would really be able to do. Mm-hmm. I think, like, 5 years ago, the idea with machine learning, because there were like machine learning models back then, things like Siri and stuff, which have been around for, I don't know, just like Siri and like Google Assistant and things like that,
yep,
that use AI learning models, or, like, you know, the ability for you to search your photo library for a picture of a dog and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, back when that was sort of like the state of the art stuff that people were being, people had exposure to that had to do with, like, machine learning models. I think at that time that was happening, and you know, like, yeah, maybe in the last, like, 10 years and up until this year, the idea was that, like, oh, like, one day computers are gonna, we're gonna be able to train them to do, like, you know, simple tasks, and that's gonna make it, like, really, like, that's gonna wipe out, like, a whole, like, bottom part of the economy where, like, you know, easy to learn tasks are just gonna be taken care of by, like, computers and robots, you know. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, I think, like, if you extrapolate from sort of, like, what has happened with machine learning this year, it turns out that, like, really the jobs that are at stake are, like, the ones that people always thought were protected, you know, like, oh, computers will never be able to do creative work, you know, like, they'll never be able to. And it turns out that, like, I mean, I don't want to pretend that there's, like, you know, a consciousness behind the AI art generator. There's not. It's looking at millions of images that are produced by, like, really great human artists, and it's, like, cross-referencing them and figuring out what what aesthetically, you know, makes up a composed image, and then it's, like, transposing that into a language model where it can understand what a dog looks like and can generate a picture of a dog. Like, there's no actual creativity behind it. But, like, it takes this huge piece of, like, the creative process where, like, if, for instance, if you, like, are an artist and you have writer's block, you know, like, you can just put in a prompt and have a starting point without really, you know, having to think about it. And I don't think that that's what people were expecting, but it seems like that is, like, going to be the first sort of, like, preeminent kind of set of human abilities that like, realistically, like, machine learning models are going to be able to take over.
Right. But surely is what it's looking like. Surely, Shale, our jobs as chefs are safe, right? Right, Shale?
Welcome to Food Court. I'm a computer and I'm here with Alan Sutterby and Chael McDonald. They are two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. They love food and they love to talk about it.
Yeah, boy. Turns out that our normally we do, like, you know, a cold open that has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about on the episode, but I don't know, some reason, I guess maybe all we can think about is that our jobs are at stake. So this episode is going to be about about menus generated by a very specific machine learning model called ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. Should I say something about what ChatGPT is, Alan? Do you think most of our listeners already know? Or
I didn't know what it was until you showed me your menu.
Okay. I'll see if I can describe it without going off on a weird tangent and do it in a way that makes sense.
Why don't we just ask ChatGPT what it is?
ChatGPT what it is? I think I've done that before.
Yeah.
And I can't remember.
Basically, whenever I try to use ChatGPT as a search engine, it reminds me that it's not a search engine, that it doesn't have access to the internet, and that's a large language modeling.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it says that it is in a second here.
We can also nix this idea and you can just explain it to us.
Yeah, that might be what happens.
That's fine.
Okay, so here's what ChatGPT says that it is. I asked it, what is ChatGPT? It says, GPT, short for Generative Pre-Training Transformer, is a type of language model developed by OpenAI. It's a machine learning model that's trained to generate human-like text by predicting the next word in a sequence of words. GPT can be used for a variety of language tasks, such as translation, summarization, and chatbot dialogue. In the context of chatbots, GPT can be used to generate responses to user input real-time. The chatbot can use GPT model to generate a response based on the user's input, creating the impression of a conversation with a real person. GPT-based chatbots can be used in customer service, online education, and other applications where real-time conversation with a machine is desired. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like a long-winded way of saying that it's a machine learning model that runs on a server that you can interact with in a conversational way. So it remembers what you said. And it generates responses that a lot of the time sound like read like you're talking to a person on the other end.
And specifically a very friendly customer service person. A very yeah, helpful, totally. Friendly customer service. There's an attitude built into it that it's like it's there to help you and happy to help you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's
because of that it's overly verbose.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like you wouldn't really mistake it for a human because it just is, it like is so thorough in its answers that you're like, no human would ever be this thorough.
Yes.
But that can definitely be helpful if you're looking for information.
Mm-hmm. And it's as I got into some weird conversations with it. So this service attitude is part of trying to develop what's called friendly AI. And yeah. So I asked the bot, what is friendly AI and what's the opposite of friendly AI, and went to some weird places in the conversation with that.
Oh, that's funny.
But that's beyond the scope of this podcast.
Did you guys wind up talking about Skynet?
No.
You know what Skynet is, right, Alan?
That's the Musk project for high-speed internet access everywhere in the world.
Oh, no. That's a Starlink.
Yeah.
Skynet is the rogue AI that takes over the Earth in the Terminator series.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
I have not seen that in 25 years, so I
yeah, fair enough.
Forgot.
I'm pretty up to date on all my Terminator stuff, so.
Okay, so how did you get the idea? ChatGPT is not really designed for creative work, but you were able to make it do some creative tasks in menu writing. Is that right?
Yeah. So why is this a topic of conversation on our podcast? I guess is the answer is the question we need to answer. And the thing is that like I was just kind of playing around with it because I'd heard some stuff about it on some of the tech podcasts that I listened to, and specifically I had heard that that some students were using it to generate papers,
right?
And that, you know, they had to do some like pretty specific interaction with it to get a good result, but that basically it was like producing papers for students based on prompts that were reasonable, like high school and university level like papers that you could hand in and potentially get a good mark on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It definitely has some weird limitations. Like it's very confident in its answers, and that makes it seem like what it's telling you is always verifiably true.
Mm-hmm.
But in some cases that is not actually the case. And that becomes especially apparent if you're like talking to it within a domain that you have expertise in. You can sort of like pick out where things are not exactly true or that are completely false in some instances.
Yes, I had some conversations like that. I was asking it about, you remember our our conversation about the futurist Italian restaurant in Milan. I was asking
I've been thinking about it a lot actually lately for some reason. Not only because of like because there's been futurism knocking around in my head, but also because I don't know if you've seen Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
Not yet,
but there's like a whole bunch of stuff in there about Mussolini, and I was really it really brought to mind like
I was talking to the bot about that restaurant, and it was it said a couple of things that weren't correct, and so I it was interesting because like I could correct, like point out the error, and then it usually was like, oh yes, you're right, my mistake.
It usually cops to its error and then kind of like parrots back what is the correct information, but then it's hard to know whether it's like just parroting back what you told it or whether it actually like, you know, goes back into the model and is like, oh, there's, you know, conflicting information here or something. I think in a lot of cases, one of the things that they were saying, and I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on this, but like one of the things that they were saying on the podcast that I was listening to is that like what can happen, and especially in terms of situations where you have a lot of written material on a subject, is that it can become difficult for a learning model like this to discern. Let's say you have a common thing in like philosophy is for, you know, maybe like two philosophers to have differing views and for them to be aware of each other's views and for them to have some discourse about it in like their, in the books that they produce or in letters that they write to each other historically and things like that.
Right.
And what winds up happening is that like you get a lot of devil's advocate arguments, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so you get one philosopher saying something that is actually contrary to what they believe, you know, in order to come around to a different point about it. And so it can be really tricky to discern like who holds what view in that situation, because in some cases, you know, both sides, like both people on both sides will be offering arguments for and against each view in order to strengthen their actual argument. And so, you know, it's fairly easy for a human to discern that if you read all of the text, but if you're just sucking in all of the text as like, you know, as just like words that are going into a training model, that kind of semantic understanding can, I think, get quite a bit more complicated. So yeah, I think that's sort of what happens, is like it has information, some of which is correct and some of which is incorrect, and it's usually pretty good at like picking out what the stuff is that's correct, but oftentimes it represents things that are like a devil's advocate argument or things that are incorrect as like a correct answer to your question. So yeah, that's a little, I don't want to say dangerous necessarily, but you know, it definitely is a pitfall of how it's currently operating. It can't really check the veracity of its own of like the information that it's providing.
So I don't know how exactly you want to go about it, but you ended up getting a very...
long story super long. I started playing around with it just for fun because I was curious. And then while I was like sitting in front of it, I was like, I wonder if this thing can produce a menu or something, or recipe. Is it aware of recipes? Does it know anything about food? So I started asking it like food related questions. And I asked it to, let's see, what's the first prompt I asked it? Oh yeah. So the first prompt that I gave it was like, can you produce a menu for a 12 course harvest dinner? And it gave me like, you know, a paragraph of like a preamble paragraph, you know, saying that it's not really able to like fully, you know, browse the internet and find recipes and things like that, but it could give me some possible suggestions for a 12 course harvest menu.
Yeah.
And then what it spit out was like, honestly, pretty stunning. Like,
yes.
And so then I kind of went down a rabbit hole of like, you know, trying to interact with it more to see what I could do to like, to sort of like nudge it in directions that I wanted it to go in, if I wanted to sort of like go down a different creative path and like I got like a few menus out of it, and like we can go through one of them, and I know that you've generated one as well, right?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so like maybe we can each kind of like quickly go through our menus and just like sort of like pick out what's good and about them and poke holes in them or whatever. Mm-hmm. But just like kind of like the overall sense that I got after playing around with it and getting it to generate a couple of menus, like the first time that I interacted with it in that way, like the broader takeaways for me is that like it understood what 12 courses in a menu meant.
Right.
And then what it provided was, you know, like maybe like, you know, for me being a chef who has made a lot of similar menus, maybe not as creative or something as I would like to, you know, potentially keep the menus that I'm making, mm-hmm. and maybe not as cohesive or like, you know, like maybe not every course I think like would like follow the previous course perfectly. Like there are definitely like things that I would change, but like it definitely like provided 12 courses. It definitely provided food that was mostly like seasonal to what like food you would find in the harvest season. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all of the flavor combinations that it mentions in the menu that it generated are like totally reasonable flavor combinations that would work well together.
Right.
And like all of the courses in this 12 course menu, aside from like one kind of like sort of glaring omission, are basically in the right order, like for how you would want to serve those courses, like in a dinner.
That's interesting, because I had a little bit of issue with that where where it would yes, it would provide 12 courses, but for it didn't seem to understand always like even something simple like that, you know, the sweet courses shouldn't be in the middle of the, like they were basically putting desserts in the middle, and also kind of basically duplicating dishes. Like, so one of the themes of my menu was Ukrainian, and it would have like vareniki and pierogies on the same menu, which are basically the same thing. And
right.
So it would produce that, and I would say, well, okay, those two are too similar. Can you replace the vareniki with something else? And also including drinks as a course, which I thought was kind of odd.
Oh, yeah, that is odd.
Like a liqueur or something like that.
I mean, it did, I think, we'll get into it and I'll read my menu, but I think like, yeah, the very last course that it spit out for the first menu that it gave me was actually a digestif. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was like an actual course that was a drink. So yeah, it did that to me too, but it put it at the end.
Okay.
Which, you know, I mean, I probably, I wouldn't count that as a course in my meal probably. So I guess technically it gave me an 11 course menu. Mm-hmm. And then also, it gave me a palate cleanser and a sorbet course, one right after the other, both of which were sorbet. Mm-hmm. So one of those would have to get kicked out, but it definitely provided like, you know, 10 courses.
Right. Yeah.
So. And I easily could have gone back to it and said, oh, actually, can you replace the sorbet course with something else?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to keep like the very first, I generated a few other menus as well, but I kind of wanted to just like talk about the very first one that it spit out without any further interaction from me whatsoever to try and correct it in any way.
Okay. Yep.
So should we, why don't we go through mine first and then we can go through yours after? Okay, cool. So I asked it for a 12 course harvest menu. It gave me a disclaimer.
Yes.
Pretty long disclaimer
about
the information that it was going to provide. It always provides some kind of disclaimer and says, look, don't use this to try and do anything important. Mm-hmm. But then it said, here are some suggestions for courses that could be included in a 12 course harvest dinner. Mm-hmm. Appetizer, : So the name of a course, like it didn't say like course one, course two, course three, course four.
Yeah,
you know,
it says progression. Yeah,
it says appetizer, roast vegetable tartlets with a creamy herb filling.
Yum.
I'll go through the whole thing and then we can talk about it.
Yes.
Next course is soup, butternut squash soup with apple and ginger. Then salad, mixed greens with roasted beets, goat cheese, and a honey balsamic dressing. Fish course, pan-seared salmon with pumpkin seed crust and a maple cider glaze. Maple cider glaze, sorry. Palate cleanser, lemon sorbet with fresh mint. And then sorbet course, spiced apple sorbet. Pasta course, butternut squash ravioli with brown butter and sage. Main course, roasted turkey with chestnut and sausage stuffing. Vegetarian option. I mean, that's also kind of weird. You know, like the vegetarian option wouldn't necessarily be a course. You might just have it available if one of the diners was vegetarian, and you might make a bunch of the courses vegetarian to accommodate that. Yep. And then the ones that you couldn't, you would have a separate option. But
I'm just impressed.
Appreciate the effort, though, ChatGPT.
Yeah. Pretty thoughtful.
Yeah, exactly. Vegetarian option, roasted portobello mushrooms stuffed with quinoa and cranberries. Cheese course, selection of local cheeses with honey and fruit compote. Dessert, pecan pie with vanilla ice cream. Digestif, spiced apple cider or pumpkin liqueur. I hope these suggestions are helpful. If you need more specific ideas or recipes, you may want to try searching online or consulting a cookbook. Oh, ChatGPT, such helpful advice. So, the obvious things right off the bat are that, like, you know, it shouldn't have a palate cleanser and a sorbet course. Mm-hmm. And then it also, provided a vegetarian option as one of the courses, which, you know, I would have I would have gone back and been like, oh, actually, you know, can you provide me another course that I could have for people who don't want the vegetarian option or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the very first problems with it. But like, it was shocking to me how like reasonable this menu is.
Yes.
And like, and what's also like kind of, I don't know, like I think part of the reason why it's so shocking to me is because like, it's not, it didn't provide this based on any sort of understanding of what food is, you know,
right.
Like it doesn't know anything about food. All it knows is that it has a bunch of, it's ingested a bunch of text in its learning model that maybe has the word menu somewhere around or in it. And then there's a bunch of food related words that have, you know, been in or around semantically the word menu or something, and it understands, you know, like, and it knows, like, it understands what 12 is, and yes. from that
it's a computer shell.
Like, from that it's able to just put words in order that, like, you know, basically are a usable menu concept. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's very creative. You know, there's a lot of things on here that I definitely wouldn't serve necessarily in the current form that they're represented in this menu.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's here seems pretty like cliche kind of a little bit.
Some of it, but not all of it. I don't think.
Not all of it.
Like,
but,
that
but
salmon,
yeah, definitely
course, the salmon with the pumpkin seed crust and maple syrup. That sounds great. And I wouldn't have thought to crust a salmon with pumpkin seeds.
Yeah, totally. You know, like the things that I think sound a little bit cliche to me maybe are, I hesitate to say this because it's like probably one of my favorite desserts of all time, but I mean, pecan pie with vanilla ice cream, that's pretty simple. I probably
sounds
wouldn't
great.
Necessarily put that.
It sounds
that?
Great. Why would you?
I mean, it's
be
still
upset if someone
shouldn't have said it. I shouldn't have said it because now I'm never going to be able to live it down. Probably one of my favorite desserts of all time. Very simple, but, you know, also not super creative. And if I was planning a 12 course meal for people, you know, I was doing something to like really blow people's mind with the pecan pie or like doing it in some kind of different way or something like that.
But did
I
you come
necessarily?
Did you come back at it with prompts to say like, well, actually, I need this to be a very creative menu to impress important friends and see if it had anything. Do you know what I mean? Because like you asked for a 12 course menu and yeah, sure. Butternut squash soup and beet and goat cheese salad. Like, yes, that's, I wouldn't go so far to say it's a cliche, but you're right. It's not creative, but it's delicious.
Yeah.
And it sounds, it all makes sense in the context of the prompts that you gave.
Yeah. Shockingly good.
Yeah.
Like,
I want to eat it.
Like, yeah, like pretty unbelievable. You know, like it knows that, like, you know, as an appetizer, you know, you would want to serve something small. It's like, it's a roasted vegetable tartlet. It's like a little piece of food that you can like probably eat in a couple of bites with creamy herbs, you know?
Like, sounds great.
It sounds great, you know? Like, all of these sound like legitimate dishes, like butternut squash soup with apple and ginger. Like, that all sounds great. I was blown away when I saw this. I was just like, this is like legitimate. Like, somebody could put together and cook this menu. Every one of these dishes, just I just read the text for it and I pretty much understand how I would go about cooking it. It's not like there's something standing out here where it's like, oh my God, like, you know, you would never put pomegranate with, I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
Like, everything, it's sort of like, when I read it for the first time, I was like, what text did it read to under to like be able to generate like flavor combinations that are like this like cohesive? And obviously there's no way to really answer that question, but like looking at this, it's like it read what's that book with all the flavor combinations, the Flavor Bible? Like, I feel like every one of these dishes you could just look in the Flavor Bible and be like, oh yeah, these things go together.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah, it was shocking to me.
So I don't know if you were planning on sharing this, but what really blew me, like, this is a great menu.
Yeah.
What really blew me away was your fusion menu that you had it make.
Yeah. Because... So we can move on to that if you want. I wanted to like definitely make sure that we had time to talk about your menu, but yeah, like I think we're at the point where I can sort of like talk a little bit more about how in depth I went with it.
Yes.
So after I got this menu, I was like pretty shocked that it was able to provide something so cohesive. But then I was like, okay, well, what if I wanted to use this as a tool to actually like help me with the creative part of my work? You know, like, like, it's nice that I have this menu, but it has nothing to do with what potentially, like, which ingredients I might potentially have on hand or something like that. Right. And so I need to be able to interact with it in a way where I could say, hey, you know, like, that's a nice idea, but I need to replace this food with that food or something because I have a whole bunch of this that I need to use up. And so what did I say? So the very next prompt that I gave it was, that sounds good, referring to the above menu. I didn't have to say, oh, the menu that you just provided or something like that. Yeah. I was like,
yeah,
that sounds good, but I also need to use some kabocha squash and lamb leg in the menu. Can you suggest some courses which use those ingredients as well?
Yes.
And what I was expecting to get back is that it would change a couple of the courses in the menu to utilize lamb and or kabocha squash. But what I got back was pretty like also surprising in a crazy way, but not exactly what I was expecting, or maybe not even what I was hoping for. But it basically rebuilt the menu, and with every course it used lamb and kabocha squash, which is ridiculous. Obviously you wouldn't have a menu like that, but also it like definitely, you know, then if I wanted to go back to the previous menu and utilize some of the previous menu, but I just needed to replace a couple of courses so that I could use up some lamb leg and kabocha squash, I could then pick pretty much any course out of the second menu that it provided and use it to replace one of the courses in the first menu.
And it forced it into some pretty creative spaces, didn't it? By saying that
it did.
It's understanding that
some of the dishes on this menu, I feel like, are more creative than in the first menu that it provided. I'll quickly go through it too, just because it's kind of hilarious to read. So the appetizer, kabocha squash and lamb skewers with mint pistachio pesto. That sounds delicious.
That sounds so good. I
know. Kabocha squash and lamb soup with cumin and chickpeas. Yum. Also sounds, oh yeah, and also like a lot of this really has like a Mediterranean or like Middle Eastern feel to it, which I, you know, which makes sense. But like because of the lamb and the way squash and lamb might be used together, but I kind of wasn't expecting that either. Salad is arugula and lamb salad with kabocha squash, feta, and honey mustard dressing. Sounds great. Fish course, still suggested pan-seared salmon. I'm not sure if it understands that there are other fish besides salmon. But
I know chefs like that.
Pan-seared salmon with kabocha squash and lamb hash. There's kabocha squash and lamb in like every one of these dishes, just about. Except for the sorbet course, spiced kabocha squash sorbet. maybe. I don't know. Like, I feel like I could make that good, but I'd probably just choose something different. Mm-hmm. Pasta course, lamb and kabocha squash ravioli with rosemary cream sauce. Main course, roasted lamb leg with kabocha squash and hazelnut stuffing. Vegetarian option, grilled portobello mushrooms with kabocha squash and lamb hash. Kind of a fail there, ChatGPT. Not sure if ChatGPT really understands what a vegetarian is either. Cheese course, selection of local cheeses with kabocha squash and lamb sausage.
Okay, I mean, yeah, sure.
You know, yeah, like kind of like a charcuterie board. Yeah. Like it understands that the sausage can go with the cheese on a board or something.
Yeah.
So crazy. Dessert, kabocha squash pie with whipped cream and candied lamb bacon. Not sure if I would make it, but man, like it put lamb on a dessert in a way that kind of makes sense.
It's gutsy. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah, and then the digestif is kind of...
let me guess.
Digestif is weird. Spiced lamb liqueur. Ever heard of a lamb liqueur, Alan? Didn't think so.
No.
Was it I don't like think that that's something that you can really make.
A lamb fat washed spirit.
I mean, you could do that, yeah. But I don't think you can make a liqueur out of lamb. Or kabocha squash infused bourbon. That sounds nice.
Sure, yeah.
So yeah, that was my second prompt. It gave me a menu that basically every dish had kabocha squash and lamb in it, mm-hmm. which, I mean, somewhat helpful, kind of weird.
But you can cherry pick some of the good ideas from there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then then I was like, okay, I felt like it kind of misunderstood what I wanted there, mm-hmm. you know? And so I just went back to see if I could get it to sort of like correct itself. So I said, I like the first set of suggestions better, but there are some good ideas in the second set for using the lamb leg and kabocha squash. Can you just replace a couple of the dishes from the first set with a couple of items that use either lamb leg or kabocha squash? And could you also give the whole menu a bit of a Japanese culinary influence? Mm-hmm. Just for fun. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yes. And then it probably gave you a hilarious preamble on... what the main components of...
I mean, not a crazy one. It wasn't like a huge disclaimer this time. It was just like, sure, here's a revised 12-course menu for a harvest dinner that incorporates lamb leg and kabocha squash and has a Japanese culinary influence. And it said, appetizer. And also, like, I don't know how much of this is just kind of luck because kabocha squash tends to be like a pretty... an ingredient that's in a lot of Japanese dishes,
right? Yeah.
And so, you know, like that my two preferences might have like kind of like run up against each other and like made some magic here, but mm-hmm. But it came back with appetizer, kabocha squash and lamb skewers with mint pistachio pesto. So that was like the first one from that's just like directly ripped from the lamb and kabocha squash menu. Mm-hmm. Soup, butternut squash soup with apple and ginger, so that's directly ripped from the first menu. Salad, mixed greens with roasted beets, goat cheese, and honey balsamic dressing. That's straight ripped from the first menu. Fish course, pan-seared salmon with kabocha squash and lamb hash. So that's directly ripped from the second menu. Palate cleanser, lemon sorbet with fresh mint, directly ripped from the first menu. Sorbet course, spiced kabocha squash sorbet, directly ripped from the second menu. Pasta course, butternut squash ravioli with brown butter and sake.
Mm.
So, you know, like, not a... like. You know, you'd probably want to change that a little bit more. It's, you know, like it's still probably primarily Italian and not so much Japanese. But the mm-hmm. inclusion of sake definitely helps with the fusion of the menu. Mm-hmm. Main course, grilled lamb leg with kabocha squash and shiitake mushroom sauce. That's, I would say, Japanese culinary influence. Mm-hmm. Vegetarian option, grilled portobello mushrooms with kabocha squash and lamb hash. Cheese course, selection of local cheeses with kabocha squash and lamb sausage. Also directly ripped from the second menu. Dessert, matcha green tea tiramisu with candied lamb bacon. So that's like a weird, like a brand new dessert that it came up with that has a Japanese influence, but then it kept the lamb bacon because mm-hmm. I guess it thought that was a good idea. I don't know.
Right.
And then Digestif, kabocha squash infused sake is what it gave me. I hope this revised menu incorporates your preferences and adds a Japanese culinary influence. As a large language model, I can provide general suggestions and ideas, but I don't have the ability to access specific recipes or browse the internet for more information. If you need more ideas or want to explore different flavor combinations, you may want to try searching online or consulting a cookbook. And then, yeah, I also, after that, asked it for an just like a straight omakase menu, mm-hmm. just to see what, it, like, if it could identify what that was and see what it would do, just like providing like a Japanese menu. But I was like, what did I say? I said, can you provide a omakase menu, but with a bit of Italian influence?
Right.
And then, man, it's so crazy. It says, omakase is a Japanese term that means I'll leave it up to you and is typically used to refer to a meal at a sushi restaurant where the chef selects and prepares the dishes. An omakase menu with an Italian influence would likely incorporate Italian ingredients and flavors into traditional Japanese dishes, or use Italian cooking techniques to prepare Japanese ingredients. Here's a suggested 10-course omakase menu with an Italian influence. Appetizer, octopus carpaccio with lemon, olive oil, and capers. Soup, miso soup with clams and pancetta. Sashimi, toro sashimi with truffle ponzu sauce. Tempura, shrimp tempura with basil and parmesan crust. Sushi, uni sushi with lemon and olive oil. Man, that sounds delicious.
Yes.
Grilled dish, grilled eel with cherry tomato and basil sauce. Noodle dish, udon noodles with lobster and white wine cream sauce. Rice dish, aburi sushi with Italian sausages and truffles. Dessert, green tea tiramisu with matcha and sake. Digestif, limoncello or sake with yuzu.
We've been building to this point. That menu right. is so sophisticated.
Yeah.
It absolutely shocked me. Like, yeah, each one of those sound excellent and like so perfect, yeah. like such a smart integration of the two cuisines. Like, it's
right,
it's crazy.
And from both angles, like, yes. right, like it gave like a definition of like how it thought you would create that menu, and there's two approaches, and it outlines both approaches. It says either you could incorporate Italian ingredients and flavors into traditional Japanese dishes, or you could use Italian cooking techniques to prepare Japanese ingredients. Mm-hmm. And it does both.
Yes.
And it like intermixes them in this menu. It uses Italian dishes and substitutes Japanese ingredients, and it uses Japanese dishes and substitutes Italian ingredients.
Yeah.
And the suggestions that it came up with are like totally like the first menu, like great flavor combinations. Secondarily, like creative, like mm-hmm. creative combinations.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know if that creativity comes from like, you know, saying, can you combine Italian and Japanese cuisine? And then it does it in a weird way, but keeps the flavor combinations that it knows works. And that's where the creativity comes from. But like, it just like feels, I don't know. It's so weird. It's scary. It feels authentic.
Yes.
You know, like it feels like something that a chef would have come up with if that was their intention.
Yeah.
Was to make like an omakase menu that had some Italian influence mm-hmm. is what it feels like. It was shocking to me. So,
and, like, I don't yeah. think there's a single course on that menu that sounds out of place or not, like, where the flavors don't make sense or anything. Like, it really is a sophisticated menu.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and on top of that, like, I've never, like, I've made several, like, multi-course tasting menus, but I've never really, like, I've eaten a few omakase, but I've never developed an omakase menu. And, like, if I had to, I would have to do a whole bunch of research to really understand what the progression would be like.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like right off the bat, it already knows better than I would what the progression would be.
Right.
You know, just yeah. by the names of some of the courses in here, like that it would have like a grilled dish and
right.
a noodle dish.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah,
like
totally.
It wouldn't necessarily occur to me that all of those particular courses would, you know, generally be represented. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like reading it now, looking at it, I'm like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. And that's probably in most cases what the omakase menus that I've had, those, that's sort of like, you know, all of those types of dishes are represented in them. But like off the top of my head, I wouldn't have been like, okay, well, we need to have one dish that has noodles and we need to have
right.
one dish that has like some kind of grilled protein. And, you mm-hmm. know, like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's pretty crazy, pretty shocking. And then, yeah, I think, oh yeah, and then the hilarious thing is that, like, I didn't even spell omakase correctly when I asked it to generate this menu. Mm-hmm. I spelled it wrong, and it was still like, oh, I know what you mean. Look, guy. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's just shocking. And then, you know, like, obviously after that, I started to have a little bit of an existential crisis.
Right. So, well, that, okay, so that's a good segue. Like, what do you think that there's a way for you to use this tech in your current job for some creative aspect? Like, what,
I mean,
what kind of prompts would you ask?
I can ask it for ideas for, like, my current job being, like, you know, I guess, like, the creative part of my current job being, like, coming up with potential, like, ice cream flavors, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, I don't need it.
Right.
There's, like, so many, you know, like, it's, you know, it's pretty, I get inspired about, you know, new things that I might want to try with ice cream flavors. And then we have so many suggestions from the people that work at Kind and the Kind owners and things that they've seen. And there's just, like, this huge list of, like, potential suggestions for things that we might want to try. We don't really need any creative input because it's a pretty small mm-hmm. creative problem space.
Right.
And there's already, like, an overflowing wealth of, like, you know, of potential ideas. So
what about,
I don't really need it in my current job.
What about not, like, so not the initial concepts themselves, but say, like, if you're making an ice cream and you want it to be, like, say, like, it's Snickers ice cream.
Right.
And so, you know, it's going to have caramel and peanuts and fudge and chocolate, whatever. But then there's, mm-hmm. we've talked about this before, but there's, like, dozens of different ways that you can get those flavors in. Is it in the ice cream base? Is it in the inclusions?
Right.
I wonder if there's,
that's interesting. I haven't really asked it any questions like that. You know, like, mm-hmm. I haven't really asked it for suggestions for how you might go about making a Snickers ice cream or anything like
right,
that. You
yeah.
know, like if I wonder, like, well, for instance, like, one of the shift leaders at the kitchen is like working on an idea where it's like blueberry ice cream with lemon shortbread,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I wonder if I, like, put that question to it, why don't we just try it right now? How would I make a blueberry ice cream with lemon shortbread? Okay, yeah. So it's just giving me a recipe mm-hmm. for one potential iteration.
Oh, okay.
So it's giving me a recipe for, like, blueberry ice cream, and then it's giving me a recipe for lemon shortbread, and then it's telling me how to make the two things and how to combine them.
Right.
But it's not really saying, you know, like, there are several options for how you might want to combine those flavors.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me see if I ask it for another option for how to combine the flavors, what it says. Oh my God. It's like still working on its shortbread recipe.
Right.
What's crazy is, like, I could ask it for a shortbread recipe again, and it would probably provide something similar, but it is actually, like, writing this recipe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, mm-hmm. And the next time that it writes it, it's probably going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it'll probably wind up having a similar set of steps and a very similar procedure.
Right.
But, you know, it'll generate a completely different recipe if I asked it again. So I'm going to ask it, are there different ways to incorporate blueberry flavor and lemon shortbread into ice cream? It says, yes, there are several ways you can incorporate blueberry flavor and lemon shortbread into ice cream. Blueberry swirl. One option is to make a batch of vanilla ice cream and swirl blueberry compote or puree. To make the compote, simmer fresh blueberries, and it's telling me how to make the blueberry compote. Blueberry ripple. Another option is to make a batch of vanilla ice cream and stir in a rib and a blueberry sauce. Sounds like the exact same option. Blueberry ice cream base. You can also make a batch of blueberry ice cream from scratch using infusing the milk and cream with blueberries and lemon zest to do this, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so it gave me, like, three pretty reasonable options.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's giving me a few options for how to incorporate the shortbread as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the answer is yes. You could ask it to iterate. I don't think I would ever want or need to use it for that. Mm-hmm. Like, once you have the idea... I don't know, like, this might not be true for all cooks or chefs, but, like, once you have the idea, to me, like, coming up with a range of approaches
yeah.
is sort of, like, not very difficult but also somewhat satisfying creative work.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so this could definitely take that away from me by the looks of things, but you know, like it's not something that I feel like I need help with.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like I feel like if I'm like working with a set of flavors and trying to create a certain type of dish, I have a pretty good idea of like what the potential options, like what the potential option space is, and then I can explore those options and use like the variety of potential options to like help whatever dish I'm going to create
right.
fit into whatever the like potential logistical constraints are, you know? So like, you know, there might be like a certain dish that you want, a certain type of salad that you want to create, and maybe like, you know, maybe one of the options to incorporate lamb flavor into that salad is to make lamb bacon or something, but
right.
maybe you don't have the facility to do that. And so then, you know, maybe you want to incorporate the lamb flavor in a different way or whatever. And so like, I feel like it would be difficult to communicate enough with ChatGPT to give it a big enough understanding of like, not just the creative problem space, but also the logistical problem space to make its suggestions like fully helpful and accurate
mm-hmm.
to bounce ideas off of, though. Like, yeah, definitely like a crazy tool to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, even if you just need to like start a conversation, start a brainstorming session about ideas about a certain type of food,
mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe like in a lot of cases, I feel like that's all you need to sort of like start the creative process
yeah.
is just like somebody to bounce ideas off of, or somebody to suggest something that you can actually, this is going to sound bad, but like one of the greatest benefits, I think, of something like this, like an AI that you can potentially bounce ideas off of, is it's never going to be upset if you tell it that you don't like its ideas.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
Right. And like when you're brainstorming with other people, like it's, you know, it's good that there are those boundaries there, and that, you know, like, and you can have a conversation, and that it's probably helpful in some ways creatively, is like, you know, understanding that you should be accepting of someone else's ideas and stuff. But
right.
like here, you could just get it to generate like, you know, 100 ideas and be like, I don't like this one, I do like this one, I don't like this one, I do like this one.
Yep.
And just like, you know, get it, you know, and it's never going to take offense, which like, I mean, sometimes that can be, if you're trying to collaborate with someone in a way that like involves that sort of like back and forth brainstorming, in some instances it can become a little bit difficult,
yeah,
because you may just not agree on, you know, what you want to do creatively. And so for someone who wants to do some creative work but doesn't want to be encumbered, like, I don't know, I love creatively collaborating with other people, but it, like, you know, in an instance where you just want to do some brainstorming and you don't want to necessarily have to like avoid the social pitfalls of
right.
collaborating with someone on a creative level,
mm.
You know, like, you're not going to offend the AI.
Mm.
It's just there to help you. Or at least I hope that we never get to the point where you might offend it and it might take something personally. Mm. That to me is the point at which I feel like it might start to get a little bit frightening.
Right. Your Japanese Italian menu
mm-hmm.
Was so inspiring to me. I tried to take ChatGPT down a type of fusion cuisine that we've kind of sort of talked about a little bit on the program.
Right.
And it's this half joke idea I have of doing a fusion of Ukrainian and like Chinese Canadian like food.
Right. Which is a very like hyper local type of fusion, I feel like, for like central Alberta.
Yes. But we've talked about like, so one example is one episode we talked about beet fried rice, where it's like
right.
fried rice that's made with bacon and little cubes of beet. So it gets stained purple and stuff like that. So,
right.
I tried to see, you're right. It's very niche. When I started talking about prairie Ukrainian culture and Alberta Ukrainian culture, ChatGPT was just like, no, I don't know what that is.
Right.
But it knows very well what traditional Ukrainian cuisine. And I guess it, And I know that we've talked about how it's silly to say Chinese cuisine and all that, but I'm talking about Western Chinese food as it's served to North Americans.
Right. And if you are specific enough about it, I'm sure it probably has like a pretty good, I mean, quote unquote, understanding of the difference between those two things.
Mm-hmm, totally. I tried it a few different ways. Like I got it to, for the first couple to write a 12-course traditional Ukrainian menu for me. Mm-hmm. And then I asked it to incorporate Chinese influence into it. I was curious because I had spent so much time thinking about this in the past. I was curious to see if it struck on a lot of the same things that I had already come up with. It did a lot of the stuff that you would expect, like adding ginger and scallion and maybe Sichuan peppercorns and stuff like that to, say, borscht or something like that.
Right.
I was happy that it did actually specifically recommend using shasu pork instead of kielbasa. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Do you want to just read your menu?
Sure. I had a few. I'll read the one that I liked the best, actually. Was a little bit, I was surprised at how open-ended it was, and it kind of like, it still provided 12 courses, but it gave more like some general ideas, like you could do this or you could do this with this.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the prompt was, this is one where I didn't have it start with the Ukrainian menu and then add influence. I just outright said, I'd like to write a 12-course menu for a special event. I would like it to be based on traditional Ukrainian dishes, but to incorporate Chinese influences. And then,
oh my God, Alan, it must love talking to you. I'm just like, hey, guy.
Well, and it when you talk to it properly, it actually talks back to you very. This is what it says: sounds like a unique and interesting menu! Exclamation point. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, that's great.
Here are a few ideas for dishes that you could include on your 12-course Ukrainian Chinese menu. 1, charkoye. A hearty Ukrainian stew made with beef, potatoes, carrots, and onions. You could add some Chinese-style spices like star anise and ginger to give it a unique twist. Huh. Very thoughtful.
That's interesting. I mean, like, yeah, that's very descriptive, like much more sort of than just like spitting out the menu items or whatever.
Right, yeah. Like, it's not just saying beef stew with star anise. It's like...
Yeah, exactly.
Here's the jumping off point. Here's the twist. Course 2, pelmeni. Traditional Ukrainian dumplings filled with meat and served with sour cream. You could try filling them with a Chinese-inspired filling such as pork and napa cabbage. Mm-hmm. 3, borscht, a classic Ukrainian soup made with beets, potatoes, carrots, onions, and sometimes meat. You could add some Chinese flavors by using hoisin sauce or Chinese five spice in the broth. I don't know about putting hoisin into soup, but...
I don't think that would be very good, ChatGPT.
One of the other iterations, it always recommended borscht. One of them actually suggested egg drop soup made with borscht, which
that's a good idea.
It's an interesting idea.
I think that could be good.
I suggested my retort to that was that I thought that the eggs would look super weird stained red, but
yeah, kind of what I was thinking is that like instead of doing egg drop, you could just do you could like do soft poached quail's eggs right. in it,
yes,
or something,
yeah,
which would also be kind of Chinese-ish
and
inspired.
Just get your unpaid stagiaires to peel the quail eggs for you, and bada bing, boom. Yeah,
no, they're kidding. Poached, Alan. There.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I see. Yeah,
not soft boiled, oh, okay. But poached. Yeah, you could poach them in the soup, and they would probably still get stained a little bit, but not as much as if you were like just stirring in eggs or whatever.
Totally, yeah,
yeah. Because you're right. I think that would look kind of weird.
I'd still try it. Or you could do something like, actually, I think what I suggested in that version of this conversation was that I like the egg drop idea, but instead of basing it on borscht, base it on kapuzniak or something where it's like a broth soup. Like it's still a Ukrainian soup, but it's a broth soup with pork and cabbage, and then you could do the egg drop in it.
Yeah, totally.
So anyways,
sorry, you suggested that back to it?
Yes.
Or you were just thinking, oh, and what did it say about that?
I think actually I said, can you replace the borscht in the egg drop soup with kapuzniak. Like I kind of ordered it to do it. And so it was just it rewrote.
So it just spit out a menu that said, okay.
Yeah. Course 4 is vareniki, Ukrainian dumplings filled with sweet or savory fillings such as mashed potatoes, cheese, or berries. You could try filling them with Chinese style fillings such as shrimp and chives. So, you know, a shrimp and chive pierogi pot sticker, that's a cool idea and very much in line with the kinds of things that I've thought of in the past in this space.
Totally. Although I do feel like, you know, there's enough similarities between the dumpling types that you could wind up just with a Chinese dish.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, you know, it would just, you know, by losing some of the, in some of these cases, I feel like by losing the filling that would traditionally be in the Ukrainian dish, it would just turn into a Chinese dish because the like dumpling wrapper or something might be so, might wind up being so similar that
totally,
it would just,
Course five, grilled skewers. Ukrainian cuisine often features grilled meats. So I like this kind of like general information that it's providing, such as chicken or pork. You could give them a Chinese twist by marinating the meat in soy sauce and honey glaze.
I wonder if that's because like your prompt was like, I'd like to write a menu being a little bit more explanatory, like, you know, if you want to write this type of menu, this is the type of thing that would be on it and here's why.
Yeah,
you know, whereas when I gave it a prompt, I think I was just like,
write my menu,
make me a menu.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And yeah, so I wonder if that's the difference. Anyway,
that's good know, because I do find this type of response quite helpful, and I think that you could easily you could say, those ideas sound great. Can you draft a menu for me? Like, and I think it would do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Course six, kasha, traditional Ukrainian dish made with cooked grains such as oats or buckwheat. You could add Chinese flavor by using jasmine rice instead, or by stirring in some hoisin sauce or Chinese five spice.
It loves hoisin and Chinese five spice.
Yes.
As like the alternative flavor influence. I can think of quite a few things that would work better in like the buckwheat than those things.
Yeah, but, I agree. And then seven, Ukrainian style stir fry. You could combine traditional Ukrainian ingredients such as potatoes and carrots with Chinese style stir fry vegetables such as bok choy and bell peppers. I don't know exactly how that would play Ukrainian at all. So that one fell a little flat for me. And then
if it was only Ukrainian ingredients or something, like
right.
if it was potatoes and it was flavored with dill and it had kielbasa and
you know
if it was just like strictly, but then I don't know then if it would come across as a stir fry either, so I don't know, it's weird.
And then there's a handful of the remaining courses that are basically just like don't incorporate the Ukrainian element to me at all. So for instance, course eight, it just says Peking duck, a classic Chinese dish that could be a fun and unexpected addition to your Ukrainian Chinese menu. Which, fair enough.
Right.
But yeah, I thought that was interesting.
But it's kind of lost the fusion element for that one particular dish.
Yeah. And another dim sum, small Chinese dumplings or other bite-sized dishes that could be a fun and interactive addition to your menu. But again, doesn't really spell out for me how that plays to the Ukrainian side.
Yeah.
Likewise, egg rolls, another classic Chinese dish that could be a tasty addition to your Ukrainian Chinese menu. And it's easy to take the creative step and be like, oh yeah, like you can make an egg roll, but you could put whatever sauerkraut in it instead of regular cabbage. Right. And then actually the most exciting thing that it said, which was part of this weird space that I hadn't ever thought of, but it said fortune cookies, a fun and traditional Chinese dessert that could be a playful way to end your Ukrainian Chinese feast. And that's a great idea because there's lots of
An idea that you would have come up with if you were actually planning this dinner. Like there's no way that you would have served this dinner without putting a fortune cookie at the end of it.
But it could be like, cause there's lots of different, you know, every culture has different kinds of deep fried dough. So it could be like a fortune krishtiki, which is like Ukrainian deep fried dough. That was the single most exciting idea that came out of it.
It's pretty cool.
But yeah, I thought it's actually a really fascinating tool, a really fascinating creative tool.
Like for creating a jumping off point or for creating like a space where you can sort of like, bounce ideas off of something or like, you know, just get feedback on an idea that you have or something like that. It's like shockingly useful.
Mm-hmm. The title of this episode is going to be Chefs Need Not Apply, right?
I think so. Yeah.
That's good. So if anyone doesn't know, that is an allusion to a YouTube video called Humans Need Not Apply by YouTuber CGP Gray. And if you don't want to sleep tonight, you should watch that video. It's really, really fascinating. The thesis of it is that AI is already here, first of all. And second of all, like you mentioned towards the start of this conversation, it's not just self-driving cars and transportation workers that are going to be part of this. It's really, it is going to come after artistic professions. And true professions like in medicine and engineering
and legal.
Legal. And so, and this is it's a crisis, not for the science fiction reasons that we might think of in terms of AI, but in terms of if this computer can do your job a bit more reliably than you or cheaper than you, how many people are going to be put out of work by it in the coming decades, and what's going to happen to them?
Yeah, well, and you know, like I don't want to, I feel like the obvious response is like kind of a fear response, right? Like, what's going to happen to my job, right?
Right.
If, you know, like, if, like, let's say that I feel like the reason why I am good at my job, the reason why I'm a good chef, you know, like, is, you know, has something to do with my skills as a cook, but primarily has to do with like my understanding of food and my ability to creatively think about food and develop ideas for it. You know, like the obvious reaction here is like, oh, am I going to be required to do the part of my job that I feel is like the most human part of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And like this, you know, like the surprising thing about the stuff that's happened with machine learning and AI this year, I think, is that, like, you know, sort of what I was saying at the beginning is that, like, I think from the most part, people didn't really feel like it was coming for the creative aspect of what people do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think most people thought it was coming for the drudgery and for the analytical parts, you know, that computers are good at.
Mm-hmm.
But turns out that you can mimic the creative part really well as well.
Yes.
And I think that's a little bit shocking to people. And then I kind of understand why flipping that idea on its head creates like a bit of a fear response, because it's like, okay, well, the parts that we thought were safe are definitely not safe.
Right.
And especially if you look at something like DALL-E 2 or ChatGPT as like, you know, an impressive study in what you can do creatively with like a machine learning model, like the fact that it's here now and as good as it is, to me, I mean, and I think that this is where the fear comes from, means that like it's surprising that it's here and this good already. And so what's that going to look like in 5 years, in 10 years?
Yes.
Like, it's going to be way better, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to...
Because you're training it. We're spending all this time training it.
Yeah, and we're not going to put Pandora's stuff back inside her box. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Really interesting.
I can see why it generates... I can see why, like, the sort of, like, primary reaction is a bit of a fear response, like, what's going to happen to my livelihood? This is the thing that I'm good at, that potentially a computer is going to be better at than I am in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I fully understand that response. But I don't think that that necessarily means that everyone is going to lose their job.
No.
You know, I definitely feel like it's going to be disruptive. But, you know, like, most of these things with technology, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, so, you know, potentially we can build a small airplane. Oh my God, in 10 years, everyone's going to be driving a flying car, you know, like, and that, you know, and then when you sort of like start to bump up against the logistics of the real world, you wind up realizing that it's maybe not that simple, you know, mm-hmm. and that maybe it's just easier, safer, and better for people to keep driving cars that go on the ground, you know, like, and part of that sucks because you get stuck in traffic and you're like, man, if I had a flying car right now, I'd be out of this traffic jam in a jiffy. But like, you know, like there's just a lot of other concerns when it starts to really bump up against like the real world and how many types of things need to be generated and, you know, and what people want to do with their time, you know, like, you know, it may be a situation where you don't necessarily need a person to pay a person to be creative, but, you know, like the economy can change, how we earn money can change,
mm-hmm.
how we think about what is valuable for people to be doing can change, you know, and those things don't necessarily have to change in a negative way. And, you know, and I'm sure like in a lot of cases, if we don't do something to sort of like preemptively try and figure out where that change might affect our society, we can wind up in a bad situation. But I think that, like, you know, I like, this is like a dumb analogy, and I kind of hate to use it because it's a little bit like the uncreative version of the menu, but it's like cars put a lot of horses out of work, but we still have horses.
Not as many.
You know, like, not half as many. I agree. And I don't know, maybe there will be half as many people in 50 years. I don't really have an answer to that question, but I don't think that necessarily having a tool that can replace people's creative work necessarily means that people are going to be obsolete.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's the fear, right? But, you know, people can be as obsolete as they want to be, you know? They don't have to be obsolete just because a computer can also do their job. Right. You know, they could continue to do it. And it may not strictly be necessary in some cases. And therefore, like, some of those cases may get relegated to, like, more like hobby status, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and less like necessary jobs that like the market will definitely pay for. But, you know, I do think that we're also, you know, in terms of the discussions that are happening in terms of providing universal basic income for people who can't get jobs because, you know, things like unemployment are bigger problems to solve than they have ever been before. Like, those discussions are happening. And I think mm-hmm. that, like, you know, over the course of time, while we rub up against like these things where, you know, it's much more convenient to have a computer do somebody's job or have a robot drive a car or something like that, I feel like, you know, we will be forced to like work our way through it in a way that winds up being holistic for the society or mm-hmm. for people in general and people who want to remain employed. And I feel like it's not totally crazy to have some optimism about how we might be able to solve those problems.
Yes,
you know,
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you agree. but it is scary. Like, I understand, like, you know, that's definitely part of why I got so excited about it in the first place, is like partially a fear response. Like mm-hmm. I looked at the menu that it wrote and I was like, I'd probably pick this apart, but honestly, like you could serve this to, like, you know, you could serve this to some foodies and they would definitely enjoy it. Like, it's pretty shocking.
They'd be like, two sorbets? Oh my God.
I mean, I would be upset about two sorbets, but probably somebody would be like, oh, that was interesting.
There was actually in a review of Alder Room which one does Dan Clapson write for? Shoot, I can't remember if it was the Globe and Mail. Shoot, I can't remember. But anyways, one of their reviews was they had two sweet courses and they were both ice cream and they were pissed. They were pissed. Mad. They were like, this place needs a pastry chef. Anyways.
Yeah, well, if this was 2022, they could have had a robot pastry chef.
That's right.
Boom.
Yeah.
Problem solved. Yeah, I think what's kind of interesting too is that, like, it's turning out that, like, the like logistical things, like self-driving cars and things like that, that's turning out to be like a harder problem to solve than just, like, you know, coming up with like ideas and generating like creative like art or you know, or text and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like it's starting to look like kind of the reverse is true, is that like blue collar jobs are going to be harder to replace and white collar jobs are going to wind up being easier mm-hmm. to replace in the next like 5 to 10 years, mm-hmm. which I think, you know, is part of why there's so much sort of like stir up around it, is that, like, that's kind of getting that the reality of that situation is sort of like becoming apparent.
It's coming faster,
you know, that like the reality of driving in a snowstorm is like
that's
much
exactly
harder
what I was
than
thinking. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I drove to a family reunion for Lisa's mom's family in just east of Lacombe somewhere. And that was the exact conversation people were having. It was like, we drove here today.
Like, there's no way a robot could do this.
There's no lines on the road. How's the robot going to drive the car today?
Yeah, and that's legitimate. That, like, because they do, like, as Teslas especially, they use data from cameras, not just from like they strictly use data from cameras, so it's what you can see. Mm-hmm. You know, like some systems use like radar and LiDAR, which have a better chance of like seeing through rain or snow and mm-hmm. things like that. But those systems are also not perfect. So it's a really hard problem to solve. Mm-hmm. And it's turning out to be like way harder than most of the people who have been working on it for the last 10 years thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And and bad weather is like a big part of it, or just like bad weather or roads that aren't kept very well,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Like that's the real world. And, you know, you don't have to worry about that when you're coming up with an idea for a menu,
right.
You maybe have to worry about it when you're trying to cook that menu for mm-hmm. maybe like, you know, 100 or 1,000 people. Like maybe that's the harder problem to solve, is like
right, yeah.
how to make it good every time is the hard problem to solve, and how to come up with the ideas. Turns out it's just like, you're not as smart as you thought you were,
yeah.
human.
ChatGPT can't season food properly, so.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.